Welcome to Wise and Nice, a true crime podcast with your hosts
Danny Armstrong
and Kelly Lee.
Please remember that we mean no disrespect to anyone mentioned in this episode or across any of the Wise and Nice platforms. We have an interest in true crime and related topics, and whilst we may offer our own personal views on certain items, it is meant to be educational and as light-hearted as possible. The information we present is collated from research gathered from the internet, and we reference and credit our sources wherever possible.
If you've liked what you've heard and want to join in with us, follow us on our socials, Instagram, Wives and Knives the Pod, Twitter, at Knives Wives, and Facebook, Wives and Knives Pod. We also have a little website where we post photographs and other information about the cases that we research. And this is wivesandknives.wixsite.com/my site.
Hello and welcome to Wives and Knives.
Hello, everybody.
I hope you're all doing well. The world is a horrible place, but I hope your little world is okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
How are you, Kelly?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Yeah, busy, busy. I told you in our pre-record chat, we have got a new addition to the family, and that's Rubble the hamster. So welcome, Rubble.
Welcome, Rubble. Amazing.
So cute. I'll send a cross picture of him.
Yeah, definitely. And happy birthday to one of our original Wives and Knives members, Sharon. It was her birthday the other day.
Yeah, yesterday. So happy birthday. Hope you had a lovely time.
Yes, I hope so too. Have we got anything else to say before we get going?
Well, Sharon shares her birthday with my father, so happy birthday, Clive.
Yeah, happy birthday, Clive.
Yeah, but we'll say happy birthday. It's also my little Bean's birthday on Tuesday as well, so happy birthday, Bean.
Hello. Yes, happy birthday.
I think the only other thing is we just wanted to acknowledge the Instagram post from Seeing Red, didn't we?
Oh, God, yeah. Mark, one of the hosts of Seeing Red, did a very complimentary Facebook post saying he was thinking of covering the case of Stuart Lubbock, the guy who passed away in Michael Barrymore's pool. And he said that he was struggling to research it because he thought that we had said it all. So that was such a compliment coming from him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Really. And I hope he does cover it.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sure he will.
But yeah, really meant a lot, that. So thank you very much. You know, it's been a year, pretty much a year since we covered that.
Has it?
Yeah.
Oh, time flies when you're researching horrific crimes.
Doesn't it just?
Definitely. Just a very, very quick disturbing aside. Last night I was doing a bit more research on this case and then ended up reading loads of other stuff, and I was reading a bit about blood spatter, not that that happens in this case, but stuff to do with where blood is found and what it can tell you about how somebody died. Anyway, goes to sleep soundly. I had a really, really graphic dream that I was at Wigan Northwestern train station, and there was two horses running up and down the track.
Right.
And the train was coming, and it just plowed into one of these horses. And in a grotesque but also quite cartoon-like fashion, its leg flew off, but there was blood everywhere, and this white horse was covered in blood, and it was horrible.
Wow. Okay. Feel it's like we need someone to decipher. Has anyone got a dream diary?
Yeah, if anyone is, because this morning I was like, guess what I had a dream about, not that you'd guess. And then came out with that little monstrosity. So the only thing I can think is I was reading stuff about blood, but a horse, and this white horse covered in, oh, anyway.
Wow. Okay.
Don't air true crime and sleep, guys, because this is what happens.
Right. I do you know what? I find blood splatter analysis really interesting.
Because I was, lots of things, like, you know how if somebody was to fall from a distance and there was internal bleeding, would there be any external bleeding and stuff like that? I was going down a rabbit hole of that kind of vein. Anyway, we're 8 minutes in and we've not fucking started.
Standard, I mean.
It kind of is, but I also enjoy it when people get to the fucking point, so I'm a hypocrite here. Anyway, today I am covering the case of Tamala Horsford. This is a widely covered case that people that have an interest in true crime are bound to have heard of, but any further than that, I feel like it hasn't reached mainstream media, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff on it, but it is mostly from web sleuth readers or Reddit and people and stuff like that. So troves and troves of it on the internet, but not necessarily all from hugely valid sources.
Yeah, there's a lot of conjecture, isn't there, in this case?
Definitely. And I've been wading through that. And in some respects, I'm probably adding to it with what I'm going to say, but it is undoubtedly an interesting case and definitely something that I would like the mainstream media to pick up on a little more. I feel it needs to be spoken about and more investigation needs to happen, although at this current point I don't think it will, which is extremely sad. So, Tamala Horsford, she was actually found deceased on the 4th of November 2018 at 7:30 a.m. And this is the story of how she ended up that way and what has happened since. So, Tamala was born in 1978 in the Caribbean. Americans say Caribbean, don't they?
I catch myself saying that, you know, like Caribbean versus Caribbean. I think it just depends on my mood.
I say Caribbean. I'm sorry if that offends somebody. She'd moved to the USA in 1989, the year of my birth. And she lived in the Bronx and then Florida, where she met her husband, who is called Leander. But he goes by Lee. And so I will be referring to him as Lee throughout this, and Tamala as Tam for most of it, which is what he called her. So Lee already had a young daughter, and Tam gelled with her instantly and raised her as if she was her own. It seems to be like a really sort of beautiful blended family in that respect. And as a family, they moved to Georgia. This was because Lee had a job there, so they all relocated and they were seemingly super happy. Tam and Lee actually had 5 additional kids, all boys. So busy household. That's a football team, 5. It's a lot. But Tam was super fun-loving and described as witty and open and friendly. And she seems like an amazing mum. She proper supported anything her kids were into, and she was always getting involved. There's tons of photos of her on the internet, and she's always smiling and stuck into whatever she's doing. She seems like a proper sound lady. And like I said, she took a huge interest in her son's life, and this led to her being kind of introduced to the soccer mom crew. So a load of moms, I can't say it, mums, who were well into soccer or football, because all their sons played for the same team, and that's how she met them. So this leads us to 2018, And Lee and Tam had just become grandparents to their eldest, the daughter, the girl who was older than the boys. She just had a baby, so we were super excited by this. And they were living in Forsyth County, Cumming, Georgia. So this town actually has a huge long history of racism. Up until the 80s, there was like full-on sort of ethnic cleansing protests and stuff, really disgusting stuff happening there and completely accepted.
Yeah, definitely.
Really disgusting. So obviously this place, it has like a precedence for racial hatred, and we've no actual like reports of how Tam and Lee felt about this, but they were seemingly happy living there. The October of 2018, Tam receives an invite to a party at Jean's house. So Jean is one of these soccer mums. She's called Jean Myers, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, because I would call her Jean or Jeannie.
Yeah.
But she calls herself Jean. So oh, I Jean. Will pronounce it Jean for the rest of this. So she's one of the soccer mums, and she's having a party at her house, and they'd only met in August that year, but as their sons were on the same football team, they'd seen each other a few times, and they'd actually been to Jean's house once before for a kid's Halloween party just a few days earlier. So this party was a sleepover party, like an adult sleepover party, on not swingery, just like grown-ups having a sleepover, on the 3rd of November. And Stacey Smith, another of the soccer moms, was the main organiser. Despite it being at Jean's house, it seems to be like Stacey that was sending out the invites and stuff. So there was 8 invites in total, plus Stacey and Jean. And this was supposed to be like a gals only, girls night in kind of thing. But it did end up that there was 2 guys there as well. So Jose, who was Jean's boyfriend, and Tom Smith, who was Stacey's husband. So these guys were supposed to be going out, but one of them, I couldn't find out which, had like a bit of an upset stomach or something, and he didn't want to go out. So they decided that they'd stay in as well, but they'd stay in the basement. There was actually a football game on that night that the women and the men were like excited to watch. So they were just all going to stay in, and the guys would kind of stay away from the girls and let them get on with their girls' night. So everyone bar Paula was there at 7:30 p.m. ish, but Tam was running late, so she had texted to say she'd be there a little later and would be there about 8:30. So everyone bar Paula and Tam are there at 7:30, and then Tam arrives at 8:30. And Tam wasn't hugely looking forward to going because she really didn't know many people there. From what I can gather, like, she knew Jean and she knew Stacey a bit as well, but she didn't really, like, she wouldn't call them friends. They were acquaintances.
Yeah.
Like, people you'd meet at the school gate kind of vibe. And she didn't want to seem rude. And I guess she was like, oh, they've invited me. And she had said to Lee, like, she's not that asked about going, and he was going to be going out that night anyway, but he thought, well, she doesn't go out that often and she deserves to go out. So after a bit of back and forth, like, they decided that she'd go and she'll probably have a great time and he'll look after the kids.
Yeah.
So, like, and this wasn't, it wasn't like she really, really, really would have preferred to have done anything else. She was like super outgoing and friendly. From what I can gather, she was just a bit like, oh, I don't really know why they've invited me, but it should be fun kind of thing.
Yeah. I bet it's hard, like, wanting to make friends, but also it's kind of like you said before, friends of your sons. So it's,
yeah,
kind of get that. I'd be like, oh, I should go.
Well, I think as you get older, it's like making friends is a bit weird.
Yeah, true.
And you make friends more sort of infrequently than when you were a kid.
Definitely. But I think when your kids are at school, I find I do it myself. I feel like I have to sort of talk to people at the school gates, when in reality I'm like, oh, I'd rather just be listening to my podcast. And
yeah,
but you do it for the kids, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So she arrives and they've all got into their PJs because it is, yeah, it's like proper sleepover vibes. So Tam gets into a onesie that has like paw prints on it and tons of pictures online. They're all dressed similar, like PJ kind of things. And Tamala had bought a bottle of tequila for Jean as like a thank you for inviting me, this is for us all to drink kind of thing, because it was like they were going to be drinking at this. One of the reasons it was a sleepover was so they could all have a drink.
Yeah.
But Jean made it very clear that she didn't like tequila. And following Jean's lead, because she defo seems like the ringleader of these gals, all of the other women sort of turned the nose up at it as well. And they passed it round and sniffed it and like made like vomiting sounds, you know, like, oh, oh, which is fucking rude.
Yeah, totally.
It's very sort of Mean Girls, high school vibes, I find this. And you might be thinking, how do you know they did that? Well, because they've all fucking said they did. Like, they've discussed it heavily in interviews and they see no sort of disrespect in bitching about this gift that their friend, who is now deceased, brought to the party. And Jean in particular says she threw up in her mouth when she smelt the tequila. They said that Tam was saying it was special and imported from Mexico, and the way that they talk about her, it's like, oh, she was all excited over this tequila, but it was disgusting.
I don't particularly like tequila, but if someone's brought an imported bottle of, like, you know, nice tequila,
yeah,
do that. I'd be like, oh, it's not my cup of tea, but mix it with some fruit juice and yeah, I'll crack on, it'll be rude.
Yeah, if somebody, like, I am the type of person that if someone cooks something for me or brings like a drink or something, it's like, oh, that's for me, I'd be like, oh, thank you so much, and I would fucking eat it even if I didn't like it. Like,
yeah, I think she's you know, being very polite, and she's bringing, you know, a bottle for the party.
Yeah, it stuns me how these women talk about ridiculing a gift.
Yeah.
As if, like, that's fine.
Mm.
Anyway, everyone was drinking, apart from Nicole, who had planned to go home that night. Jennifer was very drunk, like, absolutely paralytic drunk. And this wasn't unusual for Jennifer. Jennifer had actually got a DUI quite recently, and she was one of the reasons that they were like, no one will drive home from this, you will all drink. So just to go over, I've just started naming people. So Jennifer was one of the ladies there, as was Nicole, but I'll just go over the other names of the people there just so we've got like a good overall. So obviously there's Jean and Stacey, Jean Myers and Stacey Smith. And then there's Madeline. So Madeline is Jean's auntie, and she actually lived in the house as well, I believe in the basement or in like a separate little condo, but she definitely lived in that house. Then we've got Nicole, the one who was going to leave earlier. We have Marcy. We have Bridget Fuller, Jennifer, Sarah and Paula. So that is everybody who was there. And Paula is the one who arrives a little later. We'll go on to that in a second. Okay, so Jennifer was pissed as a fart, and everyone else was just tipsy and seemed okay. From time to time, Tam went outside to smoke because she did, and Madeline, Stacy, and Tam all smoked a little bit of weed at the beginning of the night. From like what I've read, it just seems like they were passing a joint round and having a quick puff, but Jean found out and she was not happy with this, so made it stop. Jean didn't want weed smoked in her house because Jose was working for the police at that time. He had been a probation officer and I believe he was working in some other police role at that time, so she was like, please don't do that in my house because of Jose's job. So they stopped. During the night, Tam actually FaceTimed Lee and said goodnight to him and the kids that were there. And during this phone call, some of the other women jumped in like on the call as well and said goodnight to her kids. So all seeming like very friendly. Lee said she seemed happy and she didn't seem particularly drunk or anything, just sort of seemed like herself and like she was having a good time. So 10:30-ish p.m. Paula arrives and Sarah and Nicola leave. Now there is definitely some speculation that this wasn't loads later on in the night. This timeline is according to the people that were at that party that were alive at the end of it, so to speak. However, this doesn't particularly tie in with phone records. So whilst everybody says that there's this FaceTime call and Paula arrived and Sarah and Nicola left, while everyone at the party says this was around 10-ish, realistically, the FaceTime call didn't happen until 12:30. I don't know, like this is just conflicting things I've read, but we can be safe to say that at some point during the night, Tam FaceTimed Lee, Paula arrived, Sarah and Nicola left, and the football was obviously over, so they decided to play Cards Against Humanity. But if you've ever played games like that before, if you're absolutely hammered, it doesn't never really last long, because you just end up laughing and talking. So Marcy takes Jen, the really drunk one, to bed and they fall asleep watching Shrek. Okay. Again, according to everybody at the party. Now, again, according to everybody at the party, it's about 1 p.m. and they all start getting ready for bed, which I find a little early given the circumstance, but whatever. Tam says she thinks she'll just drive home and she decides she wants to go home. And the others at the party say she shouldn't because she's been drinking. And as much as Tam says she wants to leave, they tell her she should stay. Now, obviously, this is according to the people that were at the party. So Lee, Tam's husband, says that his wife could really handle a drink. He'd spoken to her just before and she didn't seem drunk at all. So he felt that if she had have driven home, she would still be alive today and she'd be fine. Just a thought. I will go back to that a bit later because I find it a bit weird that she wanted to leave and they convinced her not to. But anyway.
Agreed.
They do, according to their stories of the night, convince her to stay. And everyone continues getting ready for bed. And Stacy Smith, says at this point, Tamala seemed a bit upset because everyone had, as she calls it, a sleeping buddy, apart from Tamala. And she was going to be left sleeping on her own. And according to Stacy, Tam says something like, oh, I'll sleep with you, Stacy. Just like sharing a bed, you know, like,
yeah,
sleepover thing. But obviously her husband Tom's there and she's like, oh no, I'm sharing a bed with Tom. But I will leave my phone downstairs with yours so our phones can sleep together. And Stacy repeats this in many interviews. You can listen to this on YouTube, all over. And Tamala and Stacey's phones are put together downstairs on like a console table, and that's where they are found the next morning. At this point, Bridget has decided to get her husband Gary to pick her up, and he says he will. So according to Bridget, when she is collected, Tam says she's going to have a smoke and then go to bed. According to Bridget, Tam walks her to the door and gives her a hug goodnight. Then at 1:47, we know this because there is a fancy security system in the house that records when doors that lead outside are open and closed. And it actually sends alerts to Jean's phone. So we have a pretty good idea of the time that the doors were opened and closed. The door open at 1:47 is supposed to be the door that Bridget leaves by when she gets picked up by Gary. And then at 1:49, the back door is opened and shut again at 1:50, which is kind of works with if Tam had said bye to Bridget and then gone for a cigarette outside. So you can see how that fits together. Then at 1:57, the door is opened again, but there isn't actually like a timestamp for the door being shut. So it's as if she came inside but didn't shut the door behind her, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So just read into that what you will. Obviously, and I've said it 100 times, this is only what we've been told by the people that were at the party. At 10 minutes past 4, the front door is open and closed again. Now, this was Marcy leaving to go home really fucking early, 10 past 4. Yeah. And she says this is because she is working a shift at her new job. But that shift didn't actually start until 10:30 a.m. that day. So why she felt the need to leave at 10 past 4 is beyond me. Although she does kind of pass it off as, I wanted to go home, get like a couple of hours sleep and have time to shower and stuff to get ready for work, which, okay, that's fine. Then Paula leaves at 7:30. And Stacey and Tom start getting ready to leave at 8:30-ish. So about this time, Madeline gets up, and obviously this is the house she lives in anyway, and she just goes to make a coffee. Whilst making the coffee, she sees Tam outside, laid on the ground, not moving. Now, in the interviews with Madeline, this is really fucking weird, because she says that the first thing she did when she saw Tam lay was get down on her hands and knees and pray. Not go outside, not go and see if she's okay. She gets down on her knees and prays. Then she went to tell Jose and Jean, but she goes upstairs and she thinks that they're showering because she can hear some water, so decides to go back down to check that Tam hasn't got up off the grass, which of course she hadn't. Then she goes back to Jose and Jean's room again, and this time she knocks. This sort of weird going upstairs, are they showering or not? They definitely weren't showering. They were asleep. And Jose says that he heard a light tapping on the door, then nothing, then a loud knocking. So the stories don't even add up. Just dead strange. But I'll just quote you now something that she says she told them. So she opens the door and Jean and Jose are in bed, and she says, your friend from the island is not moving in the backyard. She's not moving. I'm like, fucking hell, use her name. Like, what a way to speak about somebody, but also then to repeat it and say it in like a interview. And do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Very weird.
It smacks of racism.
Totally.
Anyway, 911 was called at 8:59. And please listen to this phone call on YouTube. It's very interesting. It's actually Jean, and then Jose goes on the phone as well. Now, this phone call was said to have been made before Jean was actually all the way downstairs. So this is what Jose says. However, this can't be true, because on the phone call, Jean says she's led face down, like describes how she's led, and says she must have fallen from the balcony. Yet she hadn't seen her yet, or had she? There's a very confusing timeline, but basically they say that she's dead and that she's fallen from a 20-foot balcony. When they're asked if she's breathing, Jose says her leg is stiff and there is no attempt to check for pulse, do CPR. And Jose would have definitely had this training because he works with the police, and like knowing how to do stuff like that is like a basic first aid training that he definitely would have known. Anyway, at 9:07, so they were pretty quick, responders arrive at the scene. Everyone there reports that she was face down with her arms by her side. That's how they describe her. So if you imagine, that's quite a unnatural position, like face down, arms by side, like a soldier, kind of upright. And that's how all the guests from the party sleepover say she was. However, when the police arrive, her arms are actually bent, so her left arm is bent up, like bent at the elbow, pointing upwards, as if she tried to stop herself from falling. This begs the question of, like, has she been moved? Has someone moved her? Did the police move her to make it look more like she had fallen? Who knows? But there was drawings taken from the scene that were made at the time with her in this position, like a little stick man of how she was on the floor. So the upper deck where they indicate she must have fallen from, some say 14 foot, some say 12 foot. In the original phone call, I think Jose says 20 foot, but realistically it was around 14 foot, like 12, 14 foot distance. And this deck, they haven't actually been hanging out on that night. Particularly, they'd gone up at one point to see if they could light like a fire pit, because there was a gas canister up there, but decided against it. But it wasn't sort of where they had been going to have a smoke or anything like that. It wasn't a place they'd been hanging out. So Jose says he's actually gone up there and moved some cigarettes and a lighter, which I don't know why you'd be moving things at a crime scene.
No.
Especially when you've got understanding of how it works because you work for the police. However, Jose, and I hate this, I really fucking hate this, he's like, oh, I'm a bit OCD and I was just tidying them up. Shut up. So the police ask Jean to call everybody who had been at the party, but they weren't separated, and the police questioned everybody at Tam's house. Like, no one was taken to a police station. It was all done as like a bit of an informal chat. Meanwhile, some officers go to tell Lee what has happened, but this is pure disgusting because they go to his door and bang his kids' answer and get him to come to the door, and they're saying, are you Lee? And he's saying, what does this pertain to? So I think at this point he's like, why are these police like hammering on the door aggressively? And if you consider what the area that he lived in was like, I don't think it's a stretch to imagine that he didn't have the friendliest relationship with the police. I'm just surmising here.
Yeah.
But he's known to be a very sort of racist area. So they're going, are you Lee? And he says, what does this pertain to? And they say again, really aggressively, are you Lee? And he says, what does this pertain to? And they say, are you Lee? And he says, it's Leander. What does this pertain to? And the police officer says, it's about your wife. She's deceased.
Oh my gosh.
And Lee wasn't allowed to go to Jean's house to sort of see what had happened, to be near his wife, right? He was just told he wasn't allowed.
Wow.
And his treatment from the beginning is disgusting. He's spoken out publicly about it, and he is such a... He's a really good advocate for Tamil. He speaks really clearly, really directly about what has happened, and you really feel for him. Like, he seems like such a nice guy. Anyway, that leads a little bit to the autopsy. So there was lots of abrasions all over her body, trace amounts of THC, which we know about because she had a bit of a joint earlier on, and there was a considerable amount of alcohol in her system. But there was also Xanax that could only have been taken that night, and they knew this because of like how much it had been metabolized. There was blunt force injuries that could have come from a fall, but more than expected. However, there was no facial injuries that you might expect from falling face first. There was also a broken wrist, and yeah, just lots and lots of bruising. And there was a lacerated heart ventricle as well. So quite a lot of contusions.
Yeah.
To her body. Something that would be more consistent with a beating or being hit by a car than falling 12 foot onto grass.
Yeah, like you say, with how her body was found, etc., like position of her arms and things, you'd expect, I would expect more facial trauma.
Yes, it's weird because some people say, oh yeah, like that, all of that could have been caused by a fall, and could have been, but it's very unlikely, and it would be more likely to be caused by something else, and then there's injuries that you would think would be present. It just doesn't quite add up. Something else that doesn't add up at all is no photos were taken during the autopsy, even though it is procedure to do so.
Yeah, that's very strange.
And within a few months, the police had publicly ruled it an accident. 100% decided, case closed kind of thing. Now, the treatment of Lee, like I've already said, was shitty, but something even more disgusting happened at the funeral home. He went to visit his wife and he didn't even recognize her because they had painted her face black. Like actual pure black. And when he was like, why have you done this? They said it was to cover up the bruising. But it's heartbreaking because Lee was obviously like, what the fuck's this? Walks out, his kids are there, and they're like, we want to see mom. Mm-hmm. And his eldest, who I think was about 15, was like, I want to see, his eldest boy, sorry, about 15, was like, I want to see mom. And he was like, no, you don't. Like, that's not your mum in there. You don't want to see her. And he was like, yeah, I do. And he's like, this is a grown-up decision, and if you see her, you're going to have to, like, live with that. And this lad's like, yeah, I want to see it. And they go in, and he says, like, neither of them shed a tear because what they saw in front of them was nothing like,
oh my God,
the woman they knew. And that's heartbreaking, but just to do that is disgusting, and I think is tantamount to the amount of racial prejudice and accepted racism within that community. Now, there's loads of other things. There is a very strange relationship between Sean and the investigators. She within a few days, while they're still all in her house, she's buying them gift cards for Dunkin' Donuts. And there's actually a recording of her being like, ah, oh, is this okay? I've bought a Cops donut cards. And like, why would she be doing that? Like, why isn't she heartbroken? Interviews for everybody were only held at Jean's house, so there was never sort of a level of seriousness that you'd get from taking someone to a police station. It was all very comfy, very cozy. Really weird. And back to the Xanax. So Bridget Fuller was the only one who was prescribed Xanax, and everybody knew she had it. She actually wore like a necklace that had some Xanax in around her neck at all points. I think it seems to have been a big part of who she was.
Oh my days, like that's bloody weird as well.
Yeah, so she'd been prescribed a myriad of things over the years, and she wasn't, it wasn't unusual of her to be sharing these prescriptions out with friends. So she says she didn't give any to Tamala, and everyone at the party says they don't know how Tamala got Xanax within her system. But it wasn't long before they found out that Bridget had been distributing her prescription meds to the other women at the sleepover. Not necessarily that they'd been taking them there, but before and after they'd given, she'd been like sharing out her meds. Particularly Stacey Smith, I think, was caught having a text conversation that the police managed to find, where she had asked Bridget for some meds that she'd taken from her before, and she said, can I have some of the ones you gave me after the incident, because it really calmed me down. And when the police bring this up with Stacey, she kind of laughs and says, oh, well, I don't remember it. But it's never followed up on. It's never made a big deal out of. The interviews available online are incredible and fucking disgusting. But Bridget's one in particular is odd. Like, I don't think she's okay in that interview. And it's definitely worth a listen. More scandal surrounding the case is that Jose actually got caught looking into police files illegally and fired. And then the Forsyth County deputy is taken off the case after leaking information and pictures from the case to two women that he was seeing at the time. He's actually using like photos to do with the case as like a, oh, look at what I'm involved in, and to try and impress people. Gross. So in June 2020, so this is like 2 years almost after it happened, Tamala's case was brought to light again following the publicity driven by the Black Lives Matter movement. And the GBI, which is the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, agreed to review the case. The family attorney that the Horsford family had hired did his own sort of investigation into it, and he says that it's a strong possibility that it was homicide, conflicting witness statements, a not preserved crime scene, badly handled evidence, and no autopsy photos mean this should be reinvestigated. Yet it was still ruled an accident. It seems it doesn't matter how many people say this is not okay, the GBI keep ruling it as an accident, and this has happened again since that time. It's ridiculous. So there's just a few more things about this case that don't add up. Open records that are available like publicly show that Tamala's case was listed as an accident, an accidental fall, the very next day. And we know this because of emails sent from two employees of the GBI between each other that basically say, don't bother testing the items that were dropped off yesterday because the medical examiner already says it's a fall, so we don't need to. So they'd given up on investigating just days after. And these emails are like really easy to get hold of and read.
Wow.
And all of this is despite the multiple blunt force injuries and the lacerated heart ventricle and the bruising all over her body. Like, how did they not think we should be investigating that? Now, there's just a few other points. She fucking wanted to leave. She wanted to leave that party. They all admitted that she wanted to leave. And even if they thought she was too drunk to drive, call her husband, get her to pick her up, put her in an Uber. And it was okay when Nancy left later on. So why didn't you convince her to stay? Why didn't Gary give her a lift home? Like, there's so many other things that if I was in that position, if I was at a party and someone was like, oh, I want to drive home, I would phone their other half and be like, hey, do you really want to come home, but they're not okay to drive? What do you want me to do about it? Do you know what I mean? Do you want me to put them in a taxi? Do you want... Convincing an adult to stay seems sketchy to me.
Like, yeah, especially when, like you just said, people are leaving at different times. Yeah. You know, it's really odd that.
And according to their version of events, it wasn't like they were convincing her to stay because they hadn't eaten yet, or they were convincing her to stay until the game was over. Like, they were just going to bed now.
Yeah.
So why? This point, along with many others, is highlighted on a YouTube channel called Justice for Tamla. And the person who runs that channel raises a great point that links to something else that I found odd, and that is the phones are sleeping together.
Yeah, that's really strange.
Yeah. So it's Stacey Smith that says, oh, we put our phones next to each other, so at least our phones could be sleeping together. And then we had a little laugh about it, and her phone was still there in the morning. Just, I don't believe it. She's a grown fucking woman, and the last one up at a sleepover, she would have her phone with her. She has kids and grandkid and a family. She would have her phone with her. Either she'd be texting people, she'd be passing time on social media or something until she fell asleep, and she would want it within reaching distance for when she woke up.
Completely agree. Yeah,
it just doesn't sit right with me. There's loads of inconsistencies, like I highlighted before, with the timings of the phone call made to Leander. There's also inconsistencies over when people have left, and all of these are so publicly highlighted yet have been ignored by Forsyth County. There's lots of back and forth that have gone on within my head about this case. Before we started recording, I said to Kelly that the first time I heard about it, I was like, oh, she was definitely murdered. Then I read into it a little more, but I was definitely only getting like a glossed version of the story. And I thought, well, it seems like it was a horrific accident that was investigated badly due to like racism within the force. But now, after reading up on it all week, I'm back to thinking she was definitely murdered, and that racism within the force only went to protect the people that had murdered her. There is a petition on change.org which has over 100,000 signatures asking for Tamla's death to be properly investigated by an outside organisation, outside to the GBI, outside to Georgia and Forsyth County. And I think that would be an incredible thing to happen.
Yeah.
But as it stands, it has, for all intents and purposes, been investigated 3 times, and every time it is ruled an accident. The last update on the change.org petition was like 8 months ago, and that was when another investigation, but again, it's the same people reinvestigating, had said, yeah, it was an accidental fall. So,
yeah,
there we go. There's tons of pictures available online. The YouTube channel I mentioned is really fascinating, or I don't know where they got their information from as well. So it is one of those where I think all the sources seem to be a bit sketch, and I'm sorry. There's some really good documentaries. It's one of those cases that people on TikTok speak about a lot as well. There's tons of threads on it. It's been covered by loads of podcasters as well. Tons of information, tons of photos. But I just think it needs investigating properly, because I don't believe it was an accident anymore. What do you think, Kelly?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think regardless of if it was an accident or foul play, the police have not done a thorough investigation. And I can't decide if, like you said, it's just pure incompetence or if there's an element of, you know, malice there. So I think definitely an external, group or agency needs to look into this, because there's just too many questions.
Definitely. There's also been lawsuits thrown into the mix by the people that were at the house that night, especially Jean. There was a woman, one of Tamala's real friends, who spoke up and said that she thought she'd been murdered that night, and there's been lawsuits filed against her. So the people who were there that night don't want this talked about anymore.
No, that's very clear. There is one thing that kind of bugs me, and it's the Xanax. You know, like you said, was it Bridget with the Xanax?
Yeah, Bridget Fuller.
I can understand, you know, giving out your tablets, you know, mixing that with a bit of alcohol and some weed, you know, is probably going to chill you out a lot, help you sleep maybe. But I wonder if Tamla took that Xanax voluntarily. Could it have been an accidental death that was covered up? You know, like they didn't want to admit that something had gone wrong at the party. But all of this now, all their actions after the event have really made it look like it's seriously shady and dodgy.
Yeah, definitely. Nothing like the bottles that they were drinking out of weren't tested. There's been so much evidence that has been lost now.
It's absolute travesty. I just can't believe it. And like you said, there's massive, massive racial undertones to the entire case, you know, which just makes it even more problematic.
100%. And I hope that anyone listening who hadn't heard of this case is really interested in it now, because the more people that know about this, the better, I feel.
Completely agree. Like, we'll, as usual, we'll put all the sources, you know, in the notes for everybody, and we'll put a link to the change.org petition as well.
Yeah, no, that would be really good. So yeah, I hope, was there anything that you hadn't heard about the case or didn't know there?
I hadn't heard about the what happened when Lee went to view Tamla, and that's just really made me feel a bit sick, to be honest.
Yeah, it's so beyond disrespectful, disgusting.
I mean, I'm not excusing that behaviour. I just wonder if lack of experience, perhaps. Do you know what I mean? It's a very, like you said a few times, it is a predominantly white area. Was that particular, were they not experienced in, you know, doing makeup? Because I'm assuming that's what you meant by painting her black.
Well, that's what I am assuming from what Leander said, but he said it's the colour of his hair compared to the colour of his skin. So
that's what I mean. Like, what had they done to her to make her look like that? Like, was that, again, was that pure incompetence, or is that like very, like, is it malice? You know?
Yeah.
It's just absolutely horrific. And their poor son, you know, I mean, I genuinely feel for the entire family, but I just think, oh my God, could you imagine seeing your mum like that? It's just horrible.
No. Well, I hope that this has highlighted her case to a few more people, and people will go and do their own reading on it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think you did a really good job there. So thank you very much for sharing that with us.
We're going to do some like UK missing cases for a bit of a joint episode next week, aren't we?
We are indeed.
Fabulous. And then it will be Kelly's case.
Yeah.
After that. So.
Indeed. Well, until then, hope everyone stays safe and keeps well out there.
Definitely. And we'll see you next week.
We will indeed.
Bye.
Bye.